Dr. Warren is currently an assistant professor at Rutgers University in the Department of Communication, and she received her PhD in 2006 from the Department of Communication, Arts, and Sciences at Penn State University, where her research examined the impact of identities on e-health information processing seeking and use and health outcomes among priority populations. And as a faculty member, she's continuing her research in tobacco control and prevention within priority populations. Okay, over to you.
Thanks. Hello, everyone. I have no relationships to disclose. I do not have a slide that says that, although I would like to share one relationship, and that is that after I finished my PhD, I spent 3 years under the tutelage of Drs. Kola Okuyemi and Jasjit Ahluwalia as a postdoc, understanding tobacco and tobacco-related health disparities and conducting a great deal of research among homeless populations and African-American populations and many other populations, I should say, and really trying to understand what are the barriers to tobacco treatment seeking, what are behavioral factors impacting that in relation to socioeconomic status, and then just a wide variety of factors that I really can't get into right now because I only have 20 minutes. As you can see, my talk, Translational Research in Environmental Tobacco Smoke, from engaging inner city early child care providers to disseminating community usable product. This was a study that was funded by Clearway Minnesota. They are a foundation that was created by tobacco settlement monies in Minnesota. And they fund community-based participatory research. So as a postdoc at the University of Minnesota, I was one of the first to receive a community-based participatory research grant to explore the issue of exposure to secondhand smoke among inner-city populations. And I have to say that because that seems rather odd, considering North Minneapolis is African-American, and why would it take so long to get research in that community to figure out how indeed to offer services to individuals living in North Minneapolis. This project is a collaboration among myself, two RAs, Brandy White and Brandy Buckless from Brandy White's from the University of Southern South Carolina. She's in medical school right now, and Brandy Buckless, who is in University of Minnesota, getting her master's in public health. And then, of course, my community partners, which are many, but the main one is Phyllis Sloan. She's an MA, and she's a wonderful woman, and without her, none of this would be possible. Now, I am not PC literate. What am I pressing here to go forward? The arrow?
Spacebar?
Yeah.
Which one?
There you go.
So the agenda today is, you know, there's a lot of stuff on here, but I'm not going to talk a lot about any one of these things, really. The goal is to get into the idea of translational research. How do you take a project that really actually has gone on for almost 6 years and turn it into something that a community can utilize, hopefully, and also enable sustainability? Because the goal is not to go in, give something, and leave once the money is gone, but to go in, create something, and have it sustain itself. And so I'm going to talk very briefly about translational research, look at some of the epidemiology around ETS, talk a bit about community-based participatory research, and then go into some of the issues with the community product, how we put it together, the training, and then look at some of the findings and conclusions. Let me get something real quick, because this is part of my presentation, too. Excuse me, I'm not conventional, so I'm going to get I have to get something because this is part of it. We're about to take it out. So, when we think about bench science and translational research, we think about people working with animals, then coming up with some kind of, you know, phase one, phase two, phase three study, finally gets to the clinician, bedside, patients, better. But what happens to the community? Actually, sometimes it even happens to the patient who is getting some of this information. But in my own sort of interaction with the medical profession, I have found a bias, whereas it is very hard sometimes when we're talking about challenged, low-income, inner-city African-American communities to get this information out to folks and put it in a usable format where they can enhance their health literacy, where they can read it, where they can use it. So it makes a lot of sense that the community would fall out, because how do we change jargon? How do we make stuff pliable, flexible? Because communities are messy, so that it can be used in a community setting. So that's just my little artwork there to show how the community might fall off the bench a little bit. So 9 million children, age of 5 and younger, may be exposed to ETS. That's a lot of people. This is in the inner city. Lower income and ethnic minorities are disproportionately exposed. Up to 80% of inner city children are exposed to secondhand smoke. And I go back and forth with ETS and secondhand smoke because that's what my community does too. They go back and forth. As you can see, serum creatinine levels are lower. In lower-income African-American children are more than 2 times higher than white and Mexican-American children. And if you do want references, you email me and I will send them to you, no problem. As you all know, there is no risk-free exposure to ETS, none. You're exposed, you have the, especially if you're a child, you have the opportunity to develop sorts of things. And of course, we know younger children are more vulnerable to exposure because they breathe more, they metabolize faster, they're on the floor, they're more exposed to third-hand smoke, the particles that fall down from smoking a cigarette, and people pick them up, they have tobacco smoke in their hair, the particles in their hair, and children are very vulnerable to the impacts, the risk of being exposed. And of course, we know SIDS is no joke, sudden infant death syndrome. A woman in my study believes that she and her card-playing cohort smoked so many cigarettes that indeed they may have caused the demise of an infant that lived in that house. And to this day, after she learned about this study, she sort of regrets their actions with this infant in this house. But lower respiratory tract infections, acute and chronic middle ear diseases, lung development, deficits in reasoning and ability. And one of the big ones I say, and that's because I am African American, when you come out into this world as an African American, and many of you may face your own challenges, you already have sort of a strike against you. And so when you are in a house where health is not necessarily seen as a priority, it sort of can create a life where illness is rife, and where you not only have that strike because of your skin color and the money you make or not, you also have a problem because now you are growing up sickly. So it is very problematic for children in these areas to begin to deal with the issue of ETS. I take this very personally, so if I sound very passionate, it's okay. I'm not going to beat anybody up. I'm not going to get mad. All right? So bear with me here. ETS is associated with asthma, and there is lots and lots of information to prove that African Americans are disproportionately diagnosed with asthma in lower-income homes, and that is under the age of 5. And many are going to the hospital for acute asthma attacks, and there are some deaths. So this is a very serious issue. Parents, we think, are the best defense for children, right? Parents, we all know we love our children. Any of you who have children, grandchildren, godchildren, or just like children, realize that they are precious. And one of the best defenses, we hope, is that parents might understand more about how to do things that are going to positively impact their life. And so when doing this research, it became quite clear that social familial networks were the primary source of exposure for children. It was kind of a shocker to me. And in my nativity, I didn't know this, you know, this is back when I was learning a lot. This was pretty interesting. And it's very, not simple, but, you know, we have things called smoking restrictions, complete bans, partial bans, no bans, So we wonder, you know, what's happening in these homes. Reducing ETS exposure related to smoking restrictions is important. African American children would benefit from this. And I will get into all the issues related to smoking restrictions, because there are a lot. I'll talk just a little bit about them as we go on. But believe me, these parents thought that they were protecting their children from environmental tobacco smoke exposure. They believe this. And the reasons why they were not is because some of these individual levels that Dr. Stewart talked about earlier, knowledge about the disease, was problematic. African Americans scored lower in knowledge than white, Hispanic, and Asian parents. And then there's system level factors. While Dr. Stewart talked about providers being able to provide information, time is limited sometimes, and they cannot go through all of the information they need to. As a matter of fact, less than half the parents receive physical advice to protect their children from American tobacco smoke exposure. And I don't know how many of you know Dr. Winnikoff. He is at UMass, and he has a program called CEASE. I can't remember the name of it, but he does a lot. Almost all of his research is on secondhand smoke and physicians and doing system-level changes to get pediatricians to deal with parents smoking. But there's pushback. Pediatricians feel that they should not be talking to parents about quitting, which would be a nice place to do this. So when I think about it, where is another place that kids go all the time? School. And if we're talking about little kids 5 years of age, where are they going? To daycares. Daycares is a place where you have a captive audience of parents. They have to drop their kids off and hopefully pick their kids back up. And there are many times for intervention with parents among secondhand smoke. So if physicians may not have the time to provide information to the parents, then perhaps daycares could provide another environment to provide this information to their children, to the children there. So we know just from some of the research that, you know, the bottom line is counseling has resulted in significant reduction in exposure based on self-report and tobacco-related biomarkers. We know this is true. You talk to parents, oh, I didn't know that. Or, oh, I thought if I went in the bathroom, you know, opened the door up, I could smoke, and all the smoke would go outside. Oh, I didn't know that it goes out into the living room. Oh, I thought when I smoked in the living room when Johnny wasn't home that all the smoke blew away. You know, no, there are particles that are there. So counseling does provide a means for parents to change behavior and to share information with other parents. So, community-based participatory research, it is very important. And as you know, over these last, I would say over the last, time flying?
No, I think about 7 minutes.
Okay. We know that over the last few years, NIH has really been trying to embrace this idea of community-based participatory research. It's been hard. They don't know how to work it because it's not clean science. It's messy science. But they've been trying to think about how that could be used to address health disparities. And so while this is not funded by NIH, it was funded by Clearway. The idea was to go into the community. I wrote the grant with the daycare facility that I wanted to work with, and we together decided on ways to get information on parents' behavior. One way we did was to have let me show you. Well, this is that's the whole group of people that I'm very proud of them. This is our parent advisory board. I don't know what happened there. That's the parent advisory board, and Miss Phyllis is on the edge over there. She's extremely ill. She has blood cancer right now. And then those are the parents in the middle. But we engaged parents, regular parents, at a regular daycare facility in the inner city. I actually was a client of this facility, and when I do my work, I don't do my work as a round-trip ticket scientist. I do it as somebody who is involved in the community, in the community. It's the only way that I know how to do research that's going to make sense. If I don't know what's going on, I'm not going to know how to really enhance anyone's capacity or how they can enhance mine. So CBPR, working with these parents, we decided to do different types of research. We did key informant interviews with the Parent Advisory Board. As you can see, I circled lack of knowledge of harms and restrictions. That was a biggie that came up. We did a survey, and we also did cotinine assays where we checked the saliva of the children to see if they were, you know, their exposure levels. So, you know, I'm not going to repeat the stuff about the fact that we know low education and poverty increases. You know, that stuff that's already been done, we know all this. But the issue that came up from our survey and then corroborating it with or triangulating it with the cotinine was that families thought they were protecting their children. But many of them lived in housing units that were connected. And the smoke, ETS smoke, was coming into their homes. So that was another issue that came up. So then we had focus groups. They didn't know what secondhand smoke was. They couldn't tell you. They were saying all kinds of things. The smoke, I don't know. The smoke, they really didn't have a clear idea what it was. And when they talked about protecting, they talked about going to the bathroom, opening the window, doesn't work. If they talked about smoking in the car with the windows open, with the kid in the back seat. And as we all know, when you have a child in the back seat, the momentum of the car from an environment, from research from the EPA shows that it blows all the smoke to the back of the car. And the EPA has shown that the toxins are so high, it's off the chart. Whether you have the window open or not, that child is getting toxins that are flying off the chart. So, limited awareness. And they also, but they did say, they thought it was important to do something. So when we meshed all this stuff together, and as you can see, we used a social ecological model down the side, we took the things that we thought that we could actually work with, and we came up with a product. And we used a slogan from one of our parents. You wouldn't give, well, why is this moving by itself? You wouldn't give your child a bag of secondhand smoke, so why expose, excuse me, them to it? Set the rules. We had to change the cancer to secondhand smoke because the board thought it was too scary. So it says something different. And so we came up with this manual. And actually, here's a copy of it. It's a set the rules training manual, and we used the cartoon on the front. We had a cartoon of one of the kids on the back, and it is a educational manual to enhance the health literacy of the population. And we're talking about the population in early daycare settings, right? And they wanted peer-to-peer. They wanted people to talk to them that looked like them. They didn't want somebody not from the neighborhood to come in. And there's 5 lessons with this kit. And we could talk about that later, but it goes through, you know, definitions of the toxins, and it goes through a lot of issues about how to set restrictions. The parents that are trained get, and this is our scientific review board, just so you know that it was scientifically reviewed. They get a bag. In the bag, it has materials that they need to share with the parents. So it's a ready-made kit that the schools do not have to make up. Everything is in there that they need to show different issues of the chemicals that are in there. And we also put in here for them their own pencils, pens, everything, sustainability, give them everything they need. And what we did, this is some of the lessons, I'm not going to go through it, but that's just lesson one, lesson outline. It goes through introducing the lesson, we tell them what to say, conducting the lesson, we tell them what to say again, and then there's a closing, and that's the end of lesson one. This was implemented in Hennepin County Strong Beginning Centers. These are not like federally subsidized centers like Head Start. This is a different type of group, but they do have partially federalized subsidized centers, and they do provide some wraparound services. There's 11 centers. We did a training two summers ago. We trained 14 providers and certified them. 10 were affiliated with Strong Beginnings. It's interesting to note, though, that when we recruited the Hennepin County daycares, which we wanted to have in our study, only 5 participated. 5 out of 11. Not quite sure why. So, demographic of some of the people that were at the trainings. There were 32, mostly women came to the trainings, mean age 35. Believe it or not, these are quote-unquote impoverished folks. Do they smoke? They say no. This goes against a lot of the epidemiological evidence that we know, that most poor inner-city people smoke. Do you have a house ban? Yeah, they said they had a house ban. Do you have a car ban? Yeah, they said they had a car ban. And so what they did was they provided us information about how they enjoyed the workshop. The content, they felt it covered things well. As you can see, the mean is a 4 or 5, and the scale was from good to bad, 4 or 5. I see ya. And the facilitator, the person who did it, they really enjoyed the facilitator. The participant felt like they would use this information. Look at number 1. That was almost a 5, that they would use it. It changed some of their values about smoking. And the centers had some feedback, but you can ask me some of those questions at the end. The centers had a lot of feedback because we're trying to make system change, like I guess Jonathan Winnikoff was trying to make system change in pediatricians' environments. It's hard. So they gave lots of information about that, and you can ask the questions later. Consider cultures within cultures. I was just thinking black folks, but there were Native American Indians there too. I wasn't considering that. I was letting people fall through the cracks. Work closely with center directors. I couldn't do that. I was doing CBPR remotely. It was very hard for me to do that. Work toward requirement for center certification. We want to have them say they're pro-smoke free in order to be certified by Hennepin County. And right now we're seeing a 21 proposal being designed to conduct a larger, more systematic study to get longitudinal data on the parents' actual behavior change if anything does happen. Thank you very much. I know I talked a lot fast because there's a lot of information. It's hard to put all that kind of community-based stuff in 20 minutes, especially with me. But this is my information, so if you want to contact me, there you go. I'm done. Thank you.